This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Speaking about changing the world, California came very, very close, and they're not done yet. Stephen Gutwillig joins me on the program. He is the state director of the Drug Policy Alliance, and he was one of the folks heading up the effort to get Proposition 19 passed. And Stephen, as I look at it, 46 people voted, 46% of the voters on Election Day voted in the affirmative to support the legalization of marijuana in California. Now, 54% voted against it. But were you surprised that it was so close? Or?
It did pretty much at the top end of what we really thought was likely, given what an uphill battle this issue was always going to be in a midterm election year, which, as you know, brings out a much smaller electorate that skews substantially older and more conservative than you get in a presidential election cycle. So 46, it's now at this point, because there were almost 2 million uncounted votes as of election night, and so they continue to count the votes in California. Our attorney general race, as you may know, is still undecided.
Yeah.
So we now have well over 4 million people who voted for the legalization of marijuana in California and counting. So we're thrilled that it did as well as it did, and are fairly energized to move forward in California and in other states.
Yeah. So what's next? What happens next?
Well, we are taking a long, hard look at 2012, both in California and in any number of Western states. The national polling continues to indicate that support for ending failed marijuana prohibition only increases in every year by at least one percentage point. So the Gallup poll that came out a couple of weeks ago indicates that we're now at 46% support for legalizing marijuana across the country, with majority support in pretty much all the Western states, and significant majority support, as you can imagine, among Democrats and progressives and folks under 30. So we're now looking hard at some combination of California, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, maybe Arizona in 2012, and it all depends on how the polling shapes up over the course of the next year and how much money can be raised to run credible initiative campaigns in as many states as possible.
Yeah, which I'm sure as you and your team have noticed over the last year or 2 years, is very expensive.
Well, particularly in California,
yeah.
For the cost of running a credible statewide initiative campaign in California, which is really $7 million, is really what it costs to not only get an initiative on the ballot in California, which is nearly $2 million right there, the cost of signature gathering, and you then need at least $3 million to run a statewide television, to do a statewide television ad buy in the major markets. It's just ludicrous how expensive California is. And so for that kind of money, you could run campaigns in 2, 3, 4 other states. And
right,
so it's
right.
just going to be a question of how big the war chest is, how excited donors are across the country, and how deep the pockets are going to be.
Stephen Gutwillig is the state director for the Drug Policy Alliance, online at drugpolicy.org. Stephen, during the campaign, what were the one or two primary objections that you kept hearing from people as you lobbied to pass this new legislation by referendum regarding the legalization of marijuana in California?
Well, of course, what's always very interesting about this issue is that everyone agrees that what we are doing today to control marijuana is not working, that it is cheaper and more potent and universally accessible to any young person that wants to get their hands on it. So no one defends the status quo, and that means that opposition to these kinds of reforms tend to pick at the way in which the reform is written and to drum up the usual kinds of drug war fear-mongering about how the sky will fall if marijuana were to be regulated like alcohol, which is essentially what this reform is about. It's about saying that marijuana, which is objectively less harmful than alcohol or tobacco, really needs to be brought, into the light of day and under the rule of law through regulation, which is the norm for how we deal with commodities that are widely available and widely consumed, yet carry some risks associated with them that have some harms. So with Proposition 19 in California, there was a lot of confusing rhetoric that came out of the opposition that essentially misrepresented the impact that this reform would have, specifically around access that young people would have to it, which is, of course, an understandable fear that some people would have, that if you take a commodity that is supposedly prohibited, although we all know, of course, it's widely available and nearly universally available to young people and regulated somehow, that is akin to condoning, if not actually promoting, its consumption, which is not the point. The point is to regulate it and control it. And otherwise, there were concerns about workplace safety and road safety. I mean, these are the kinds of issues that exist to play upon the fears of otherwise reform-minded voters.
Yeah, we're talking with Stephen Gutwillig of the Drug Policy Alliance. What about? I'm curious about the. Sometimes when you see these kind of things, you'll see commercials from law enforcement where they're so against it, and then you'll see commercials from members of law enforcement where they're really for it. Why is it you think that the folks in law enforcement are so split on this issue, or is that just emblematic of the larger public, which is obviously split on the issue?
Well, the split is within law enforcement is very interesting because, of course, there's an enormous amount of ambivalence among rank and file cops and narcotics officers, and then a lot of law enforcement figures who have been engaged for years in enforcing the failed drug war. I mean, they know better than anyone that how much of their time is spent essentially criminalizing drug use and addiction issues that are better dealt with through different kinds of health services and policies that are really about about treating people for their health problems and or just leaving people alone who aren't hurting anyone, including themselves. And so with the problem, of course, is that the hierarchy within law enforcement has to enforce the law, and so they have to publicly indicate their support for it. And it's very difficult to get any currently serving members of law enforcement to essentially come out of the closet and say, this doesn't work. There are a handful, but generally those are going to be judges maybe some prosecutors who will talk about relative priorities. But what we're now seeing is an increasingly large, vocal, and very effective bunch of retired law enforcement saying, I know that what I did in years of enforcing the drug war was a failure and a waste of my time and did not promote public safety. And that's what the Proposition 19 campaign looked like, to the point that USA Today even ran an article that was headlined, Law Enforcement Split on Legalization of Marijuana, which is very unusual because, for the most part, the stories that you hear from law enforcement are the folks in uniform and in leadership simply validating the status quo because that's their job to do it.
And whose very budgets depend on a healthy war on drugs, which is a lot of that is marijuana.
Yeah, no, everything from the fact that marijuana arrests in the United States now represent over half of all drug arrests across the country, and that 90% of those marijuana arrests are for simple possession of small amounts of marijuana for personal use. This is a terrible waste of scarce law enforcement resources at a time when local governments can least afford it. And, you know, there are subsidies from the federal government for, you know, for arresting low-level drug offenders in ways that, there, of course, there are no subsidies for any other serious crime. We arrest more people for possessing small amounts of marijuana than we arrest all violent criminals combined.
Stephen Gutwillig is the state director of the Drug Policy Alliance, and you can learn a whole lot online at drugpolicy.org. I'm curious, Stephen, now I've read all the white papers and the things at your website, and have, you know, you and I have talked a number of times, and I've heard other interviews you've done, and I think you approach this from a very sane, you know, a very sane place that's really based on research and the facts, and that so many of the folks that you know, lobby against your efforts, I don't think come from the same place, and they often certainly don't use the facts. But I'm curious, what one or two things that really resonated with people? Did you have people coming up saying, you know, you changed my mind, and I'm gonna support you? And if so, what did that?
I appreciate the compliment, and what's interesting about this issue of drug policy, and particularly around marijuana, is there really has never been an independent body that has studied the way, you know, has studied marijuana policy and marijuana enforcement and the laws that prohibit marijuana that hasn't made the recommendation, we need to eliminate criminal penalties for low-level possession of marijuana. We need to look seriously at regulating marijuana the way we do alcohol. And this goes all the way back to the very first commission that was set up under President Nixon, the Schaefer Commission, and that he and that those were their recommendations, and they and that report was promptly put in the garbage can. I mean, we have been ignoring at the national level the recommendation that we have to end marijuana prohibition because it simply wastes enormous resources, makes criminals of otherwise law-abiding citizens, and exacerbates the problems. It actually magnifies any harms that marijuana does by driving the consumption of it underground. But what we find is that no one at this point, you know, very, very few people, especially given that the aging baby boomer generation have had personal experience with marijuana. If they haven't consumed it themselves, they certainly know people who have. And increasingly, the experience that people have around marijuana as medicine, now that it is law, access to medical marijuana is law in 15 states and the District of Columbia, increasingly we're finding that people are open to this reform simply because they understand that that outdated reefer madness hyperbole is just that it is not based on science or reason, but that it is, you know, a sort of holdover from a time in which we focused primarily on mythologizing and moralizing about marijuana rather than managing the realities that marijuana presents today. And so people are very, very open to this reform and are mostly interested in trying to better understand what that reform is going to look like. And so we're in this transitional period now where increasing majorities in the populations that we discuss are completely open to abandoning marijuana prohibition, yet will be understandably concerned about the main questions of, well, where will legal marijuana be grown? Where will it be sold? Where will it be consumed? And those are really legitimate questions that reformers need to answer in clear ways, and that legislation and ballot initiatives need to be very clear about.
Yeah. Well, and this country faced those same questions when it came time to legalize alcohol, and there was a number of conversations. There were a lot of unknowns. Some of the solutions that they came up with, like in Virginia, the alcohol beverage control, and, you know, we're still doing that, which
exactly.
I think is crazy that the government is in the business of selling liquor, but, you know, a lot of folks in the legislature like that money.
Sure, there were, of course, you know, very, very legitimate concerns that led to the prohibition of alcohol in 1920, because, you know, folks were trying to address real public health and some public safety issues, you know, and domestic violence was one of the main reasons that organized groups of women were vocal proponents of alcohol prohibition, but just, you know, but within 13 years when it was, when alcohol prohibition was reversed, women were at the forefront of that movement as well, because there were so, you know, the harms to families through the, you know, the crime and the violence associated with alcohol prohibition was far worse than the problem they had initially been trying to solve. Similarly, we are starting to see both at the rank and file level and within organized groups such as Moms United to End the War on Drugs, we're starting to see parents, advocates saying enough is enough. The war on drugs is a catastrophic failure to begin with, and marijuana prohibition is one place to start reversing these failed policies that are causing so much more harm than good. You know, because you know we are not addressing the actual harms of drugs. We are exacerbating those harms by adding on this sort of open-ended criminalization, which just simply fills the jails and prisons, bankrupts local governments and state governments, and of course does really nothing to address the problems of people who have addiction issues.
Yeah, and you create an economy with private prisons that depend on a regular supply of citizens to lock up, which is why we're locking up more people than any other country in the world.
Yeah, we have, as you probably know, less than 5% of the world's population, but we are responsible for the incarceration of 25% of the world's prisoners. I mean, it is outrageous the level of incarceration in this country. One in 100 American adults is actually behind bars. And you know, this is the highest rate in real terms and in per capita terms of any nation in the world. And the war on drugs has done more than any one policy to drive the massive increase in incarceration in this country, with of course, you know, extraordinarily immoral racial disparities at the core of the way that the drug laws are enforced. And that's true of all drugs, including marijuana. You know, many people are under the impression that marijuana is not a big area within the criminal justice system, but you know, as I mentioned before, it's half of all drug arrests. There aren't an enormous, I mean, there are somewhere between, you know, 50 and 100,000 people actually behind bars for marijuana-related crimes, out of maybe 500,000 people in the country who are behind bars for drug crimes. But the most important thing for people to understand is that while we may think that the drug war primarily focuses on arresting, prosecuting, and incarcerating kingpins, or you know, people who are involved in the production and distribution of drugs, it's really not true. The overwhelming majority, you know, 80-90% of people who are arrested for drug crimes in this country, whether it's for marijuana or anything, are arrested for possession of small amounts of drugs for personal use. That's what the war on drugs looks like.
Stephen Gutwillig is the state director for the Drug Policy Alliance, online at drugpolicy.org. It's a fantastic website. We'll answer a lot of questions for you. Stephen, I guess at the end of the day, I'm just one of those taxpayers who, you know, I'm in my 40s and I'm sitting here thinking, I want the money that goes to the government, that pays for law enforcement, I want that to be spent on making the community safe and going after the threats to the community that pose a danger to the safety of its citizens. And I just don't see why going after some man or woman who's home in their home, sitting on the couch, smoking a joint, I don't see why that is a threat to our nation.
I think it's because we were sold during the escalation of the drug war in the 1980s that drug criminals were public enemy number one. There was an enormous amount of focus, particularly on the so-called epidemic of crack cocaine in the country. And at the time that President Reagan escalated the war on drugs in 1982, there was a very, very small number of people, something like 2% of Americans thought that drugs was the number one issue that faced the country. Within the next 5 to 10 years, it became, through what was largely a public relations campaign, of both the Reagan and then the first Bush administrations, it became the number one issue. It was sold to the American public with enormous amounts of money that were sent to state and local governments to subsidize their treatment of drug enforcement and to move it into first place. And you know, it has been a real distortion of what public safety issues really are in this country. It used to be that that law enforcement solved something like 60% to 70% of violent crime. They now solve something around like half of them. And there's been a shifting of focus, a shifting of resources, a demonizing of low-level drug users, and a stigmatizing of them, to the point that you know, as folks may know, we put a lot more emphasis on criminalizing and locking people up for the so-called crime of addiction than we do in actually creating the resources that are far cheaper to give them the help that they need through public health system.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, addiction treatment is much, much less expensive, even inpatient care for addiction treatment is much less expensive. It can be as little, as 10% the cost of incarceration.
And the whole drug war too, Stephen. The whole drug war too. And then I got to let you know we're out of time. But the whole drug war too was an excuse to really justify the militarization of local law enforcement as well.
In the 70s, when you and I grew up, there was something like a couple of hundred SWAT raids a year in this country, because they were both expensive and they were used for very sensitive and very dangerous operations. There are now, through the subsidies that occur from the federal government to local law enforcement, 40,000 SWAT raids every year. It's one illustration of the kind of funding that has gone into exactly what you described, Cor, which is the militarization of local law enforcement. You know, all of these SWAT teams and helicopters and all of that has largely come through drug war funding. And, there's no relationship between those kinds of subsidies and investment and public safety.
Stephen Gutwillig. Yes, Stephen Gutwillig, he's the state director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Stephen, always great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Coy. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.